rather than making them or talking about putting up a fence, why don't we work out some recognition of our mutual problems, make it possible for them to come here legally with a work permit, and then while they're working and earning here, they pay taxes here. And when they want to go back, they can go back, and they can cross and open the border both ways.
Yes, that was Ronnie Reagan in a 1980 Republican presidential debate. And yes, that is a bit of a head fake to contrast this morning's threat by the current resident of 1600 Pennsylvania to, quote, close the border permanently if need be, unquote, in the wake of yesterday's skirmish in San Ysidro between migrant caravanners rushing the fence and some of them throwing rocks, and Customs and Border Protections agents on the other side who responded with pepper spray and tear gas or tear spray or tears of a clown. Good Monday to you all, and welcome to the Reedson Podcast Editor's Roundtable Edition. I am your ceremonial puck dropper, Matt Welch, joined per usual by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Buenos dias, amigos.
Hi, friend.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
That's right. Before we get started, a bit of a special announcement, or even two, possibly three. In addition to subscribing to us on Apple Podcasts, which you should have done already, but do it again, you can now listen to us on Spotify, which is very confusing to me because I thought Spotify was designed only to mash up McCartney 2 with Double Fantasy into a techno record. But that's great. Go on Spotify. Find us. Get us there. Great. Second biggest announcement is that beginning tomorrow damned morning, we are beginning our 11th, can you believe it, Nick, 11th annual Webathon, wow, in which we are inviting you, dear listener, viewer, and reader, and freeloader, to provide us your tax-deductible donations of dollars, cryptocurrencies of your choice, not even lying about that, in exchange for various swag items and our never-ending gratitude, and in Nick's case, particularly good cheer. Go to reason.com/webathon. You can do it right now, even, and get busy. And per that, this is announcement number three, we will be recording here a live roundtable podcast Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time, which we will also stream on YouTube and Facebook. But you can also look at reason.com. We will there answer your damned questions, particularly the hostile and amusing ones. You can send those questions to podcasts@reason.com. Have we done enough throat clearing, Catherine?
Yes.
Okay, good. So let me ask you, I want to attempt to frame our conversation in vain, in a way that allows us to make distinctions between what is ideal in immigration policy in a perfect world, what is legal, what is constitutional, what is possible given our current politics, and so on. So, Catherine, in that vein, President Donald Trump has complained that with accuracy in his numbers, that asylum requests have gone up 1,700% in 10 years or so, from 5,000 in 2007 to 90,000 in 2016. So is he right in trying to change our asylum processing laws or rules or enforcement guidelines, essentially telling seekers at U.S. ports of entry to turn around?
So I think the focus on asylum claims is quite similar to our obsession of a couple of years back with the Dreamers, with the beneficiaries of the DACA program, in that it is a flashpoint. It seems like it's a contained question. Like, okay, sure, there's other stuff going on with immigration, but we can just talk about this group. And that is something that maybe we can make progress on. When in fact, neither of those things are contained questions at all. They are both, but especially the asylum question, is a question of people pouring in to a category that looks like there might be some advantage. It's basically, you know, when you're at the grocery store and there's like a whole bunch of checkout lines and one line seems to be moving faster and then a whole bunch of people get in it and then that line stalls. It's that. We all just want to check out our groceries. And
is that racist, by the way? It just seems like there's got to be.
Why? Because like
I'm
Mexicans
not sure.
work in grocery stores or something?
Not
no,
sure. Go on.
It's people trying to find a way to get even the slightest advantage in the very, 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 very high stakes game of getting into the United States on a path to citizenship.
Sounds like what we need is Peapod, but for immigration.
Yeah, we totally
do.
Do
you mean they
FYI.
Show up in little containers at your door?
And they wait on your porch till you get yeah. home?
Okay, now no,
I think that. I think Catherine is right that, you know, part of the problem here is that we have, as a country, I mean, going back at least to 2005, 2006, when George Bush, after winning re-election, talked about using his political capital to do two things. One was Social Security privatization, which went nowhere. And the other was comprehensive immigration reform, where we look at the whole system and fix it. We've been trying, you know, people both who are pro-immigration and anti-immigration have been trying to look at specific subsets within that. Figuring it's like, okay, well, this is a problem we can solve. Like we can hack off this little part and do something about it. But it doesn't actually quite work that way because all of this stuff is enmeshed and we haven't had major immigration reform in decades. And we need to have that because it is all of the parts are combined. One of the things that's interesting about the asylum seeking is that it's true. The number of asylum seekers has gone up by about 1,700% over a decade. The acceptance rate has stayed the same. About 20% of people who apply for asylum actually get granted it. The vast majority, something like 2/3, come from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, which are three countries that in the past 10 years have seen a major deterioration of their domestic situation. And we can point to at least a couple of them, or at least, you know, historically, but with Honduras and even going back to Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, the U.S. has done a lot to destabilize these countries. So it doesn't mean that we should, you know, necessarily do one thing or the other, but we shouldn't be surprised that a bunch of countries that are, you know, have been destabilized over the past decade, more people are fleeing, trying to come to the U.S. and saying we can't go back because of rampant crime and gang activity and other things that in some ways the U.S. is actually, I wouldn't say responsible for, but is implicated in.
And we've signaled that there are certain worthy categories of immigrants and that's changing, right? So we used to say, if you want to come here and work and, you know, stand in line and then come here and work, then you're allowed to come, right? And this was the thinking behind, various types of work visas, many of which also contained at least a theoretical possibility of a path to citizenship. And now we seem to have shifted to saying, well, okay, if they're literally going to kill you back home, okay, you're allowed to come. But these people who want to work, they might be bad because maybe they're taking American jobs. But then all that does is it floods the category. I mean, this also happens, unfortunately, with abortion policy, right? If you say we're going to create these very specific exemptions to an abortion ban, and this has, you know, happened all over the world in various different ways, people will apply those exemptions to themselves. They will see themselves as being in those categories sincerely and insincerely.
I'm not sure I totally follow that.
So if you say nobody can have an abortion unless there's a threat to the health of the mother.
Got it. Okay.
Then right. Everybody suddenly has a documented threat to the health of the mother. And many of those are real. And some are borderline cases where in the absence of a ban, people wouldn't feel the need to apply in that category. They wouldn't feel the need to see themselves that way. Many of these asylum seekers in a more open immigration regime would just come here. They would not apply for asylum. They would just come and say, I have a job, or I have a relative, or I have a place to stay, a place to work.
I have a dream, for Christ's sake.
I have
a
dream.
Really. I mean, no. And,
it's
and
true.
I'm, you know, the asylum seekers, particularly from the Central American countries, who are the ones who were at the border over the weekend and whatnot, overwhelmingly women and children, which, you know, also tells you something. I mean, this is part of the problem with all of the immigration rhetoric is that it, you know, on every side, people immediately go to a kind of fact-free or fact-light kind of description of what's going on. And the idea, you know, behind that, like, you know, so that you really can't argue about this one way or the other. And, you know, part of the weirdness is just that, you know, Trump had said, or the immigration service had said, you know, if you try to enter between actual like recognized ports of entry, you will just be summarily deported. Then some people started going to recognized ports, and then they're being told, no, well, we're shutting this down, or you're not going to get a hearing, et cetera. There are rules in place. If you come to the U.S. and you ask for asylum, there is a due process that goes along with that in a hearing. And one of the things that's fascinating to me anyway is that one of the, you know, if you're granted the ability to have an asylum hearing, the rate at which people, you, oftentimes you will be released into the American, you know, into America, and kind of either you stay with relatives or already here, or foster parents for children and things like that. But the rate of showing up for court proceedings, even ones that may conclude, you know, get the hell out, you're done, we're not accepting you, are in the, depending on the category, anywhere from the high 60s and 70s to the high 90% rate of compliance. And, you know, I mean, like, it would be good to be able to talk about the process and see how it works and where it's screwed up and where it needs help, but also to just kind of try and get past the idea that, you know, a couple of hundred people trying to storm the beach from Tijuana is the equivalent of Pearl Harbor or of, you know, a reverse D-Day invasion, which is the way that it gets, you know, it gets discussed a lot.
Peter, I'm reminded in the conversation so far of a couple of pieces or categories of pieces that you've done. One, I think Catherine and Nick both sort of point to a whack-a-mole situation, which that finally is racist, I think. Where we
only if they come up through the tunnels, it's different.
If it's Morocco Mole.
And you wrote a great piece called Medicare Whack-a-Mole, which talked about the kind of impossibilities of trying to contain costs there when the whole system is designed to issue checks out to providers. But also when Nick talking about the, and I think on one sense, rightly so, it is such a complicated system that you want to do it comprehensive. However, you have pointed out in Obamacare and in other things, Washington, I should say, federal government, Congress, does big badly, really, really badly. I, in fact, became persuaded on comprehensive immigration reform precisely because of the badness of big, which in this case always includes like a very intrusive E-Verify system and so on, that it might be better to work small, but then according to what Matt wants, as opposed to what, the Republican Party at any given time or to the Democrats in the 90s want, which is usually build a big damn fence. How does one approach that? I mean, is Washington at this point capable of even entertaining a big solution to this, or are you already laughing and crying and falling over?
I'm always laughing, crying, and falling over.
That's true.
Just
can verify.
All at the same time. It's how I live my life. I think that the best way to think about immigration as we currently have it in the United States and immigration policy is actually is to compare it to prohibition. And what did prohibition do? On the one hand, it did reduce drinking in the United States pretty significantly by about 30 or 40%, depending on how what stats you look at. On the other hand, that meant that 60% of drinking remained. That is a remarkable kind of failure in a lot of ways of a policy, just sort of to do what it was designed to do. And so what happens when you remove 30 or 40% of the drinking is that the remaining drinking becomes the kind of the very bad drinking, the dangerous drinking, and it becomes heavily associated with crime. And so what we see with our extremely restrictive, stupid, nonsense, quite difficult immigration policy is that immigration tends to we end up sort of incentivizing and creating the conditions for border flare-ups like the one that we saw over the weekend that then politicians exploit, that people don't like to see, that make people even more upset with immigration, that sort of give attention to a very small number in this case. And I think actually with immigration, you know, sort of we've always talked about immigrants are actually less criminal overall than native-born Americans. And so in some ways, it's not exactly comparable. But what it does is it sort of concentrates immigration. It forces people who are doing immigration to commit a crime. It is a crime, and sort of to engage in other acts that are sort of that surround and support that crime that that cause social chaos, and that end up being used by folks like Donald Trump, by politicians that end up being exploited by them. And so, to me, the best way to sort of to think about immigration is in that sort of prohibition parallel, and just and to think about what's the best way to what's the first step is to stop thinking about immigration as something that you want to sort of prohibit, and instead start thinking about it as something we want to allow it. What we want to do is create a good system for allowing it.
I would recommend also kind of considering it. And this there's no easy solution here, but Matt, you know, you played the pretty remarkable exchange from 1980 with Ronald Reagan running for the Republican nomination against H.W. Bush, where they were outdoing each other to say how much they were going to integrate illegal immigrants into the American economy because they are, you know, an absolute fundamental part of who we are as a nation and as a workforce, et cetera. To think about what's changed since 1980 and now, and part of it is that it, in 1970, the percentage of the foreign-born as part of the American population was at a historic low. It was well below 5%. Starting in the 80s, really, you know, we have had a massive and sustained immigration flow, first mostly from Mexico and other parts of Central America, and now increasingly the biggest sender countries are China and India. But we now have a percentage of the foreign-born population, which is around 14% or so, and it's getting close to where it was in the late teens and early 1920s, when we also had a nativist backlash after 40 or 50 years of massive sustained immigration of people, many of whom did not speak English and did not, you know, I always find it bizarre when people talk about Mexicans as somehow like a different race, but it's very similar to the way that people talked about Jews and Italians and to a lesser degree Poles in the early, in the 20th century. But you know, there is an anxiety about American identity, like American cultural identity, American national identity, that comes up every time there is a long-term sustained wave of immigration. The way we dealt with it in the 20s was not optimal. It was, you know, that's we created a series of frankly racist country of origin laws that basically were designed and were somewhat effective. The Great Depression and World War II were more effective, but were effective in shutting down immigration flows from certain countries. It's harder to do that now for a variety of reasons, because even China and India, they're not, you know, they're not on the border like Mexico, but we have a lot more commerce and a lot more trade and a lot more transport. But that's a big part of the question. And for the first time in many years, immigration is bubbling up to one of the top concerns. And exactly what that means is unclear because, you know, we have low unemployment, we have a desperate need for workers, et cetera. But there is a real feeling in America that somehow, you know, our borders are shaky, our very national identity is shaky, et cetera. And until we kind of can address that in some kind of meaningful way, which is not going to come through legislation, I think this type of super hyped up, super anxious vitriol is not going to go away anytime soon.
Catherine, I don't think it's an accident that that's happening as whites are becoming are on track to become a minority in the United States. I think that those
which is actually technically not true, but I agree. I mean, there's a sense of being, and you hear it every once in a while of people saying, like, I feel like a stranger in my own land, and literally phrases that legislators and authors who were trying to define Americanness in the 1920s did, that when they would go to a city and they would hear foreign languages being spoken, they would feel, you know, sick to their stomach and, you know, thinking that, you know, they had been transported to some foreign country. It's you know, the other thing that you throw in is economic transformation. A big part of the anxiety about immigration in the 20s or the teens in the 20s had to do with the country moving from rural to city to urban dominance, as well as kind of global transformations into a industrialized America. And we're seeing something like that again, whether it's about robotics or trade and things like that. it's really difficult to stage a conversation where people, like, where you can reduce the threat level so that you can at least start to have a conversation about policy.
I am going to pull a concept out of my patootie here in response to Suderman, because you hear that a lot of times, anxiety over whites losing their majority status. I am going to argue or posit that maybe it's not that. You hear that a lot. Where's that happening? It's happening in California and New York. What are immigration politics there? Well, they're not like this. I think it happens more in places like Iowa, in places where there aren't a lot of immigrants. Where do you find the most kind of, in fact, Gary Johnson has a whole theorem about this, not that I agree with it, but that the problem of Republican politics is the New Hampshire and Iowa primaries, because New Hampshire and Iowa are super, like, majority white areas that don't have a traditional influx of, or haven't had in the past, of immigrants, let alone illegal immigrants. And therefore, in those places, you're going to have the most sort of anti-immigrant politics. It's the introduction. It's not one I've lost already. It's that when I first hear that, you know, if for Spanish press or for English press too, in all of our mythological conversations or imaginations, it's then that I feel that sense of dislocation and anxiety. It's not when I live in a big city that has a lot of immigrants. But I want to pivot from that observation, which no one can object to kind
moderator of moderator tyranny.
Yep. But you can address this, Catherine, actually, in a way of kind of reframing Nick's observation about historical levels of foreign-born populations and the backlashes that ensue. One channel for noting that is to say, as Nick did, that the 1924-25 Immigration Act was had some, frankly, racist aspects to it, xenophobic aspects or whatever, exclusionary, wrong. That is an avenue, and to make those same observations updated for 2018 as necessary. Another possible way of looking at it is, if this is the case, right? If this is the case that high levels of immigration spark this, regardless of whether we like this or think this is good or valid or anything, but it is a thing that happens to people in societies where this comes up. For instance, Nick is fond of, and I cribbed this entirely in a recent op-ed about Kat Timpf, but a fond of talking about low-trust societies. Jeremy Carl from the Hoover Institute snapped back at me at Twitter here, saying, pretty rich to hear Matt Welch, the former editor-in-chief of Open Borders Reason, lamenting the decline of the U.S. as a high-trust society. Matt's solution is doubtless more immigration. I should point out that Jeremy Carl's Twitter bio includes the fact that he is all out of bubblegum. So if anyone could send him more bubblegum, I think he'd be happy. But let's take that.
That's a They Live reference?
Yeah, I know.
I didn't.
Let's take
that. I thought it was like we're here to kick ass and chew bubblegum and we're all out of bubblegum.
Yeah, but that's from They Live.
We are.
Oh, but that's not originally from that, is it? Surely that's an ancient saying.
No.
Sorry, carry on, Matt. You were making a really important point.
Sure.
And as usual, we got distracted. Okay.
But so
where Rowdy Roddy Piper and John Carpenter are concerned,
a lot of
distraction
belief
is inevitable.
Shut up, Suderman. There's a lot of belief that high immigration levels contribute to the degradation of the very trust that Nick Gillespie so holds dear. So isn't that a case for making less immigration?
Okay, so I'm going to get a little Steven Pinker on you guys, which is not an unusual turn of events for me. But here's the thing that I think. I think it is true that when faced with influxes of others, human beings are generally built to be scared of the others and to have strong individual and cultural reactions. However, I am essentially a child of the Enlightenment, as we all are in some way. And I think that we're getting better at not losing our shiz in the face of others. I think this is a documented trend. And one way that it is documented is in Pinker's book about the better angels of our nature, in which we just generally tend to kill each other less, because one of the big reactions we have to being faced with people who are different than us is to kill them historically. We do that less now. You know, this is something that I think, you know, arguably you can trace to, and we have certainly traced to in the pages of our magazine, the rise of gay rights, the rise of civil rights for all kinds of minority groups, possibly also pot legalization. You know, you can, if you get to know people who are different than you, you want to kill them less. You want to exclude them less. I actually do think there is progress in history here. And so I don't think that the correct response to, hey, historically, people, when faced with others, have freaked out and made bad policy choices is to say, like, OK, let's exclude others. It's let's see how hard we can push this enlightenment trend of accepting others, of the sort of expanding circle of humanity, so that we can benefit from it in our lifetimes.
I agree. And then I think that leads to another question, particularly in a, you know, contemporary context of, we don't think about, you know, like the Irish, you know, for, you know, hundreds of years, the Irish were considered somehow like a separate race than the English, who were their colonial and, you know, interventionist overlords. That kind of seems ridiculous now. And even within Europe, which 70 years ago, Europeans were busy mass slaughtering each other, they now have an identity, you know, which is failing in certain ways, but is also going to survive in others as Europeans, as opposed to, what's the difference between, like, you know, the three main ethnic groups in Belgium anymore? It really, we can talk about these things differently.
I will
differently.
Fight for my Walloon ancestors
Walloons. The Walloons, obviously, are the coolest, right?
The Walloon was Paul, Nick.
Yeah. but it's the same thing where, you know, how did Italian Americans, how did Jewish Americans, to a lesser degree, how did Irish Americans become white? Because at a certain point, they were not. And they were always more white than, say, Chinese or Japanese laborers or South Asian Indians, much less blacks or whatnot. But, you know, part of this comes down to kind of like, what is the large identity that America is going to offer that it allows us to have a conversation to recognize the humanity or a commonality in people who are coming here? And, you know, this is where I obviously talk a lot about the wheels going off of things. Like, we don't have we don't have coherent political narratives anymore. And the American identity, such as it is, like, you know, is it all about identity politics, which leads to a splintering and a refusal by the other, as well as by the mainstream, to accept one another as equal, or as like on, you know, legitimate. But, you know, what do we talk about, or what are the events? I mean, there, you know, one of the things that rarely gets talked about in immigration is the fact that a lot of the children of recent immigrants fought in World War II and died in World War II. That was kind of like white America, Anglo-Saxon America, WASP America, kind of had to be like, well, if you invaded Italy and if you invaded, you know, in Guadalcanal, and if you were ready to die in Japan, we're going to give you, you know, and you're Polish, or your parents were Polish, like, you know what? You're American from now on. We need to come up with something
that's happening now, though, Nick. I mean, it's not just children of immigrants; it's immigrants of immigrants who are fighting in the post 9/11.
Well, I mean, it can't be just like a military thing, though, right? Because the first, for a couple of reasons: one, that's fucked up, and we shouldn't be involved in these wars, unlike World War II. But then also, these wars are not the same. I mean, the mobilization of every aspect of American society, including the home front, everybody was working towards a common cause. We don't want that kind of common cause, but we do need some kind of common identity that is at least aspirational, but that has some meat on its bones. When I talked to Francis Fukuyama about his book about identity politics recently, which was kind of interesting, but his idea was, you know, like, identity politics has splintered us, so there's no commonality. And then his response is, well, we should have national service programs, and we should focus on being a creedal nation, you know, that we believe in ideas rather than blood and soil. And it's like, you know, come on, neither of those things is going to fucking get us, you know, off our asses. We need something different. I don't know exactly what those are, but I think that speaks to part of what Catherine was addressing.
Catherine, I heard you butting in there, and thank you for not butting in to say that we shouldn't have gone in World War II, since I know that's where your dark anarchist heart lays. But shouldn't
that was not
we...
where I was headed.
Oh, yeah. Where were you headed? Let's go.
I think I just wanted to sort of say that this phenomenon of expanding circle of humanity, of decreased violence, while I do think it's traceable to Enlightenment ideas in many cases, it's not a uniquely American phenomenon or even a uniquely European one. So, you know, I think to look for a solution that allows people to accept others in American ideals or creeds specifically may not be the right place to look. And now it may just be, an explanation that I find very compelling, which is just an increase in wealth. When you're not competing for super scarce resources, you can be more generous. That may be too simplistic and materialistic. Certainly many people find that explanation too simplistic and materialistic, but I think it's a place to start. I also think that, every peaceable interaction with someone who's different than you goes into a giant tally. There's a big scorecard in the sky of when are we going to go to war.
It's a blockchain.
It's a blockchain.
It's a distributed, distributed
true.
Register.
I basically think there's a distributed ledger of peaceful interactions between humans, and the more peaceful interaction mining we can do to increase the supply of peace coin, the better we can live.
I agree. I mean, I think that, here, just to throw a monkey wrench in it, because this is part of what I think Trump is speaking to, and it's not just him, but that, relative to other countries and relative to our past in terms of economic growth, America is declining. Other countries are getting richer. They're getting closer to us. It doesn't mean our absolute standard of living is declining, which it's not. And that's part of the problem, is that we've been dealing for a variety of political reasons in all of the 21st century, really about a declinist narrative. And I don't think we've acknowledged the idea that, like, in the 21st century, America is not going to be, the global hegemon in a way that it might have been, maybe never, but like we could pretend it was in the 90s after the triumph of communism. And being American is like, we don't know what it is, but we know it's not as good as it used to be. And I mean, that's specifically what Donald Trump was channeling with Make America Great Again. I mean, it was this idea that America is something unique and is exceptional, which I think we all agree on. We would define that differently. But, the way we're going to show it is by being more American and kicking out or restricting people who are less American. And it becomes difficult to... I agree with everything you're saying, Catherine. And it may be as simple as that if we can get back to annual economic growth of 3% or higher rather than less than 2%, a lot of this goes away. But I'm not convinced of that either fully.
I just want
every time we agree on this podcast, we mine a peace coin, guys.
All right, there you
go. Not sure.
Is it fair to get Chinese peace coin miners, or should we really be looking to the Upper Peninsula?
That's the only way that we're going to
post-industrial Midwest.
That's the only way we're going to effect Bill Kristol's regime change in China, Nick. So get to mining. I just want to point out that Nick said the phrase triumph of communism. So I think that's I think they've gotten to you over there what's it called again? You guys debated him? Jacobin?
Oh, Jacobin. Yeah.
Jacobin.
I thought you meant New York.
Well, but that's part of like this declinist narrative. I mean, like, you have fucking people who are claiming that work conditions are like, worse than the Shirtwaist Triangle factory fire or something. I mean, like, literally in that debate, and you see this come up again and again, these phantom stories of people having to wear adult diapers because they're not allowed to go to the bathroom while they're working. And it's, they're thinly sourced.
The reason office is rough.
We're supposed to have a gag order on that, but it's like, there's this sense of like, that racism has never been worse. Sexism has never been worse. Transphobia has never been worse. Everything is at its absolute worst. And it's like, if you follow, kind of the Pinker chronology, both in the Better Nature of Our Angels book, or Better Angels of Our Nature, as well as Enlightenment Now, as well as everything Ron Bailey has written for 1,000 years. It's not that things are perfect, but like, we're kind of moving in the right direction across so many different categories. And yet all we fucking do is talk about how this has never been worse. This has never been worse. This has never been worse. And it's, you know, to a point where people are actually, I mean, the whole fucking election, you know, was in 2016 was about how, oh, there aren't enough factory jobs. It's like, you know, and I don't know, in like 1950, the whole dream was that we wouldn't have factory jobs. So
Peter,
it's very confusing.
Let's leave Steven Pinker and his hair, his lustrous, lustrous hair, to the sideline, at least for the moment. I want to talk about things that are the same or not the same, by which I mean there is a strain that you see in defense of both the specific action at the border yesterday and the set of administration policies that led there, that argues, hey, dude, it's the same as Obama. There were, in fact, pepper spray bullets or little packets, little balls fired over into rock-throwing crowds during the Obama administration. There were kids sleeping in what looked like kind of dog cages back in 2014. But the president, Peter, said in a tweet in response to a 60 Minutes a broadcast about the family separation policy over the weekend, we had the exact same policy as the Obama administration. That's not true, is it?
It's not true. This is a thing that the administration and its defenders have been arguing for months, at least throughout the years. The family separations have been going on and been getting attention. And the biggest difference is that under Trump, the family separations are intentional. They are the core of the policy. And so what the Trump administration did under Jeff Sessions back when he was attorney general is they set up a zero tolerance policy for people crossing the border and basically said that if you cross the border, you've committed a crime where you're going to be separated. And then families got separated and more than 2,000 children were separated from their parents. And then, relatedly, they didn't have a plan to connect those children back with their parents. Now, what happened under Obama was that the Obama administration basically said, look, we don't have a generalized policy of separating children from parents when they cross the border. Instead, if the parents are suspected of some additional crime, drug trafficking, something like that, perhaps violent crime, they may be separated. And in most cases, they are reunited relatively quickly. And so the administration has been asked repeatedly to provide figures, for example, that would back up their contention that things were the same under the Obama administration. They cannot. Basically, everyone believes that the number of family separations was much, much lower under the Obama administration. This is not to say that the Obama administration's policy was any good or something to be celebrated or that it was working all that well. But it's not the same as Trump's. And to make that claim is it's false.
Catherine, I am going to commit a crime here by quoting from a party that you invited me to. But I saw you. I saw you over on the couch having a conversation, and you're really good at this, talking to normals about about like how
there was no one at that party who could be described as a normal.
Dan's mom is abnormal in every wonderful sense. And again, I want to adopt her as my second mom. She's phenomenal. But no, you were talking to someone who is making the claim that Donald Trump is uniquely bad to American institutions and things are really like uniquely awful. And you were saying, yeah, you know, let's slow it down here. But when you hear Peter mention this, that this very viscerally awful thing, which you have condemned on this podcast in previous episodes about the family separation, when you see choking off asylum, choking off refugees, when you see actual tweets about maybe we should close the border, which I mean, that's a terrible, awful, it's unbelievable idea. And then add that to all the trade nonsense. Isn't maybe that an argument for there's something especially bad going on?
I think you can. I mean, I know this sounds like splitting hairs, but I really do think there's an important distinction between very bad and institution destroyingly bad. And I think, you know, the things that you just listed are very bad. And I think, you know, Obama also did things that were very bad. These particular things that Trump is doing right now on immigration strike me as more motivated by seemingly ill intent, I will say. But I think still, like, politicians wreak havoc all the time. They do horrible, horrible things in the name of all kinds of supposedly good ends. And my question, the thing that I was debating on the sofa at this Thanksgiving party in contravention to all of the New York Times' advice, was, is Donald Trump going to fundamentally alter the way that the American system of government works in some irreversible way? Or are we essentially going to muddle through and maybe everything will get a little bit messier and a little bit worse for a while, and then maybe it will get a little bit tidier and a little bit better for a while? And is that how things actually normally go? And the answer is yes, of course, that is how things actually normally go. Even Watergate did not break the American system. There are still echoes of the damage wrought by Watergate, for sure. But if we are making the case, there has been, say, since the Civil War, a continuous, basically functioning regime here in the United States, and Donald Trump is probably not currently on track to destroy that thing. That is the place where I will hold the line. It's not an inspiring place, right? It's not like, yes, we probably haven't destroyed, you know, hundred years worth of institution building and civility.
It's a very important probably. You are resting a lot on the probably.
No, but I think you're fundamentally correct.
There's my hill.
No, I mean, I think you're totally right, and that this is part of the problem with, Trump derangement syndrome, whether it's on the right or the left. And, there's a lot of never Trump conservatives who are like, I'm not even in the Republican Party anymore. I'm not a conservative anymore. Trump is so awful. And in fact, Trump's, National Review, Trump is essentially, and they've kind of made peace with him, but like his platform was what they wanted for decades. And he overlaps actually in certain ways with the Weekly Standard as well. On the left, people who go full, mental on Trump, they're weirdly, not only are they wrong, but they're also playing into his rhetorical strategies where they're not going to win. You don't go toe to toe with that kind of puncher and think you're going to win because, you actually are smarter or cleverer or anything like that. And I think this is part of the problem with American political discourse right now is that it is impossible for people, both pro and anti-Trump, to step back at all and kind of start looking at things. Because then, Matt, you were fishing to be accused of whataboutism or whatever. It's like Obama was terrible on immigration. I mean, he genuinely was shitty on the topic. And then, he pulled the Dream Act, which was a reformulation of a policy that George Bush had pushed and had gotten slapped down both by Democrats and Republicans earlier in his career or in his presidency. And it's like it's worth recognizing that there's a consistency. And like, the most terrifying thing in the world might be that Donald Trump is more kind of continuous with Trump and Bush and Obama, who also had a lot in common. And, we're not even talking about fiscal and economic policy, but there's a lot of continuity there, which is, another whole order of magnitude of like terror in terms of, things like not reforming entitlements and blowing up the deficit, the budget, et cetera, and things like that.
Suderman, Hillary Clinton ruffled a lot of both European and American kind of Democratic Party feathers, with an interview.
Were they turkey feathers?
They're turkey feathers. She gave an interview about 10 days ago, I think, at this point now, where she made a series of arguments. But the one that's germane to this discussion was that European parties and Angela Merkel in particular, but others, that the way to blunt the rise of the populist nationalist right in Europe, which is on the march basically everywhere, is to deal more upfront about immigration, and that Angela Merkel screwed up in her immigration politics. She was too kind of imperious, saying we're going to have all of these either refugees or people who are in near refugee status come through without much of a democratic debate. So Hillary got absolutely roasted in American Democratic Party Twitter, at least the one that's reflected in my timeline. What's your sense of where Democrats are right now on immigration policy? Because it seems to me that there is a pretty rapid switch from 2008 Obama and 2013 or 14 Obama, from this we're going to brag literally about going after gangbangers and going after and setting new records for deportations, to we are going to stop enforcing the law on entire categories of people that go up in the millions, and we'll do it by executive order as opposed to the legislative process, because we just don't believe in legislation anymore. So where is the Democratic Party right now in your assessment on immigration? Are they finally living up, down, however you want to look at it, to the charge of open borders that they're frequently hit with by Republicans?
The Democratic Party has no idea where it's at on immigration policy, in large part because they are out of power right now. They've just regained a little bit, which they will be formally taking back at the beginning of next year in the House. But being out of power allows them to be kind of incoherent and to not have a settled policy. And so right now, the Democratic Party is, when it comes to immigration, is heavily influenced by core Democratic voter concerns about immigration, which tend to be not even close to open borders. On the other hand, quite non-restrictive, and basically to say, well, we just forget the law. We should just not enforce things wherever possible. And that is, I think you can defend a lot of that on the merits. Certainly, we've published people defending Obama's action on Dreamers. The president has a lot of discretion when it comes to immigration enforcement policy, and figuring out which things to prioritize and which things not to. But in terms of politics, in terms of a kind of a long-term or even medium-term governing agenda with regards to immigration, they don't have any idea. There is no sort of unifying party consensus, and the party is going to need to build one over the next couple of years or so, especially if they hope to, if they have the opportunity to retake more political power in Washington in particular.
Nick, do you think that there's anything to the Hillary idea that that the left has essentially, or whatever you want to term it, the non-populist right has seeded the argument, in fact, helped kind of inflame the rise of the populist right by not taking seriously their concerns, regardless of whether you happen to agree with that particular set of concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... you know, the experience of immigration in Europe and the United States is very different, and then within Germany even more, because you have like such, you know, different categories that are all kind of overlapped and messy. Where for decades after World War II, for instance, you know, Turkish workers would go to do menial tasks in Germany, but no matter how many generations were born there, they couldn't become German citizens. There was just no pathway to citizenship. This was also true of low-level workers from Italy and a couple of other countries. That changed eventually, but you know, Germany is based on, or you know, the idea of German nationality was really based on a kind of blood and soil. So like you're either born German or you're never becoming German. And I think Merkel and a bunch of other people amended those laws in a way that made sense. But then they were also absorbing East Germans, which was no small feat. And then I do think that it's probably true. There should have been more robust conversations in a number of European countries about what does immigration mean, and is it particularly threatening or not? There's also the intersection with, you know, North African colonialism by a number of European countries, as well as the rise of Islam and how that factors into things. So, you know, I think it's true that like there should have been a better political conversation about what, you know, what does it mean to be Italian? What does it mean to be French or Belgian or German or whatever? And how do we, you know, how do we expand those categories in a way that you're never going to, you know, the populist right in Europe You're not going to appease them, but you're not trying to appease them. What you're trying to do is actually create a conversation where moderate voices or centrist voices are really dominant and able to be heard and are less likely to go to one extreme or the other. I think there's something similar in the United States where, unfortunately, you know, George W. Bush, the one thing that I think he was genuinely good on was immigration and how it fit with a sense of being American. It's striking. I lived in Texas when he was governor. He spoke Spanish. He was comfortable around Hispanic people in a way that could have been transformational. But he was totally rebuked by his own party, as well as by a lot of anti-trade Democrats and whatnot, when he tried to move forward. And he bungled. I mean, his second term was a complete, even more of a disaster than his first term, which is kind of hard to say. I mean, he was a terrible, terrible president in the long run. But I do think on that, he had a model for a way where you could be American and also be kind of multi-ethnic all at the same time. And we would have done well to have more of a conversation about that back in, 2005, 2006.
All right. Before we head into our end of show, what are you reading, watching, consuming culturally? I just wanted to check in with everybody. I wanted to fact check Thanksgiving a little bit here, since there's an entire industrial factory churning out pre-Thanksgiving stories about how you should or should not talk to family members about politics. Did anyone besides Catherine have a political conversation at Thanksgiving? And if so, did you survive? Peter, did you survive?
I totally did, because I had Véronique de Rougy and Pascal Emmanuel Gobry, conservative French writer, sitting at my expanded family dinner table.
Thanksgiving frogs?
No, they are. This is the second year that they have joined my extended family, and it's totally delightful. And so, of course, we talked about how Republicans are bad, but exactly how much Democrats are or aren't worse. And there was I won't say heated, but some extended discussion of that, and a little bit of a discussion of healthcare policy and Medicare in particular. But because we were in a mixed group, including some family members, the Medicare policy discussion didn't go very far.
He was just sitting on his hands, cursing to himself. Don't you people understand? I know everything. Nick, did you have any?
I did. And I was surrounded only by family. And it is curious to me to see certain elements of my family, including the ones who actually introduced me to libertarianism, get kind of crotchety as they get older. And it's not really about material conditions kind of going south or anything, but there's a sense of anger and annoyance and frustration at the world and at these abstractions like the media and whatnot.
Sounds like you're part of the most problem.
Obviously. I have been my entire life.
But so you're not going to get crotchety as you get old, right? You're going to
not in the same way. No. The idea of I like new. I know this is banal, but it's like I like trying new ethnic cuisine. Don't you? I don't see that going away where when I turn 60 or something.
Were you just like, I'm not crotchety because I like Szechuan peppercorns? Is that what just happened here?
Just read it as
what
a
I'm saying is like,
drugs,
I'm open-ended. Like, I want to, I want the world to continually change and innovate. I don't fear that. I kind of take that as a given and then want to explore the parts of it that I find interesting. And, there is this idea, Matt, I've been reading a lot of stuff from the 70s, which you will also recall, but simultaneously
also
there were
still
these...
not sounding like an old man here. Go ahead. Carry on.
Yeah, no, I'm full of old manism. I'm not, but there are different types, and it's like, the 70s,
and you're
which
the good
is
kind.
Starting to be redolent, no, of the current moment, where there was simultaneously this kind of, self-empowerment movement, and, the individual has never been freer to try and do all sorts of different things. But also at the same time, like that civilization is absolutely declining, and it's basically over. And these two things oftentimes were it could adhere in the same person. So you get somebody like George Gilder, who on the one hand was saying, you know, the fact that women wearing pants had destroyed sexuality and Western society was over. At the same time, he was starting to talk about like infinite pro-growth strategies and life after television and telecomputing and whatnot. We're kind of in that phase now where it's like, you know, materially things keep getting better and yet people are more and more pissed off. And like, I don't want to be that person.
I tried ants climbing on trees for my favorite Chinese restaurant this weekend, and it was delicious.
It is pretty good. Can I actually jump in and say that at the Thanksgiving table proper, we did have a brief, it wasn't quite a political debate, but we do the thing where you go around and say what you're thankful for. And I, my traditional answer is usually some variation on the theme of I am thankful to have been born now and here and not anywhere else or anytime else. And my
caressing Steven Pinker's hair, yes.
Yeah, while caressing Steven Pinker's hair. And my, gosh, what is this person to me? My sister's wife's mother. What is that? She's my mother outlaw. She like disagreed with my thankfuls, and we had like a little brief is now better or worse than ever before.
What was her golden age, or what was her better point?
She did not make a counter proposal, but she felt that things were bad all over, etc.
The closest that I came to, I literally sat next to Michael Moynihan at Thanksgiving dinner. So most of the time I just tried to turn away and not
talk. You're not thankful for living now and here.
But maybe 20 minutes in the future, things would be fine.
Yeah, that's more true than you could ever know. But at subsequent galas and get-togethers, it was all about local parents bitching about a new diversity plan put together about middle schools here that's been billed as a desegregation plan, literally with slides showing Birmingham, Alabama, changing the admissions policies of New York public middle schools in our particular district. And everyone's super pissed off at it and won't talk about it because they don't want to be called racist. And it's amazing. It even happened over at Catherine's house, too. I mean, people can't stop talking about this one thing, which I will eventually write about in the pages of Reason. So what are we all consuming? Peter, I'll start with you.
I watched A Torn Curtain, a 1966 Alfred Hitchcock movie last night, and also The Birds, which I had never seen all the way through. It's one of those movies that I'd seen basically all of it in chunks, sort of picked it up by osmosis.
Never going to see that. Never, ever, ever, ever going to see that. Go on.
And I really liked both, but in particular, I enjoyed Torn Curtain, and in some ways, I think it's a better movie than The Birds, which, because it's such a classic, because it's so sort of part of our cultural lexicon, you forget just like what a weird movie it is. Like a person who like follows a random dude she meets in a pet store to the beach, and like then hangs out with his family, creates a bunch of lies to sort of pretend she has an excuse to be there that's not him. And then in the middle of the movie, the birds start to get weird and attack people. It's what? Like, okay.
I think those people were guilty of something.
Oh, God.
But Torn Curtain is a really great Cold War thriller starring Paul Newman and Julie Andrews, and in which Paul Newman plays a defector, a scientist defector who has gone, who's crossed over to the other side of the wall in order to because he is upset with the American government for not funding his project.
Do you, can I ask you very quickly, Peter, and I'm assuming you're familiar with High Anxiety, Mel Brooks's Hitchcock parody?
It's been a while, but yes.
No, but I'm familiar with both of the movies you mentioned, and I'm a really kind of a Hitchcock hater, but like, I think that High Anxiety is better than any Hitchcock movie. Like, it has everything that's good about Hitchcock and then a parodic commentary on it. So like, it's kind of like the way the Colbert Report made the O'Reilly Factor duplicative. Like, it's obsolete. You don't need it.
Even if that's true, and I don't think it is, but even if that's true, it requires Hitchcock for high anxiety to exist. And so high anxiety is to some extent it's a secondary
reality.
Yeah, but all it means is you had to read a couple of issues of Mad Magazine to understand the plots of the Hitchcock movies. I don't know.
I mean, this was a true thing, I think, probably for several people on this podcast, was that you learned the plots of movies by reading Mad Magazine. And I had not just the current issues, you know, in the 80s and early 90s when I was a kid, but I had my dad's stack from the 1960s and 70s.
Botch Casually and the Some Dunce Kid.
Yeah.
Never forget. Mm-hmm. Nick, what have you been reading besides that?
I am reading Max Boot's conversion narrative, The Corrosion of Conservatism. And he's one of, along with, I guess, Tom Nichols, a former Republican conservative who has broken definitively with Trumpism. And Boot's book, I'm reading in anticipation of interviewing him for Reason, is interesting because his parents were actually Soviet refugees. And he grew up in the 70s and 80s in California mostly. And he is still an unreconstructed kind of military interventionist. And what I find most interesting about the book is that he does a pretty good job of kind of working through a lot of the problems with the conservative movement since the kind of Goldwater years and whatnot. But he has not really come to terms with the role. And I think this is also true of Nichols, who wrote a book called The Death of Expertise, which I found quite interesting. Reason reviewed it, I think, pretty critically. They have not come. It seems to me that some of these people, and I would throw in a kind of Bill Kristol style as well, they're not willing to really talk about how their foreign policy and the implications of their foreign policy, that the U.S. can remake the world and remake the world in an American image and make it better, et cetera, how that plays into many of the problems in the contemporary conservative or certainly Republican Party movement.
I will go next in case Catherine has comments on it or anyone else. So my eldest daughter is going to be putting on the Wizard of Oz a musical at the end of the year, and everyone's all excited about it. So it's gotten us back into Wizard of Oz land in terms of stuff, and it reminded me of this book that I believe Joanna Andreessen got for us, which would make sense, which is a pop-up book of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by Robert Sabuda, based on the original Frank Baum. And of all of the pop-up books with all the doilies and the things and the stuff that's obviously made for adults as much as for kids, this is so far and away the best you will ever see. It takes forever to read. It's not a one-sitting thing for any child who needs to be read to, but it is a phenomenal piece of art. Really, a terrific pop-up book. If I was the type of 50-year-old who took advantage of the newly legalized marijuana market here on the East Coast, this is what I would spend my time looking at while obviously listening to Dark Side of the Moon. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
First, I do want to say my high school used to put on not The Wizard of Oz, but The Wiz. Which is
just
really
move on down the road.
Down the road. That's right. So it's a pretty tough ask to be hey, high school kids, be Diana Ross, be Michael Jackson. That's hardcore. But so first of all, The Wiz is better than The Wizard of Oz for a very, very specific definition of better. And the thing that I consumed this weekend was the Thanksgiving Day Parade, which as a child I always watched on TV and got to see in person the last few years, which is a total delight. For those of you who could not be there, I strongly recommend that you watch the brief clip, which made its rounds on Twitter this weekend, of the Barney balloon being destroyed mid-parade in 1997. It's truly cathartic for those of us who who lived through the Barney era, and it will be just the thing you need to start your Christmas season.
Did you inflict Barney on your kids?
No, God, no.
Okay,
no, that's nobody does that intentionally, Nick. It's just it happens.
Well, when you gotta run out and do shopping, and you just want to leave the kid at home.
So much better media now, dude.
Is he better or worse than Teletubbies?
Doesn't matter. Everything else is better than those two options. Yeah,
the real problem are the Wiggles, actually, if any of you remember that, who I expect to be Lenore Scanese will be looking into getting the Wiggles off of whatever pedo charges I'm sure they're guilty of.
Oh, my God.
My children all watch bizarre things with enormous anime eyes that I don't understand, and it's fine.
That's how all of our eyes are going to be in the future.
They are coming out with CRISPR babies, supposedly, in China. So, yeah, look for that.
I think that's all the CRISPR babies that we have time for on this Monday podcast. But a reminder, we are going off Monday, off script, to celebrate our phenomenal, fantabulous webathon. That's going to happen on Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern. And again, send us your questions. Try to trip us up, particularly Catherine, but everybody else as well. You can email those questions to podcasts@reason.com. You could probably also leave them in the comments of the post for this, but I don't know if I'm going to read that, to be honest. So, anyways, thank you for listening. Again, go find us on Spotify and subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts and all of that. And sayonara until Wednesday.
Rinky tinky tinkatubu.
Is that what Teletubbies say?
Yeah.
I've never seen a Teletubby.
The fact I did not share with restraint on my part.
Did you work as a Teletubby in Florida, Peter?
I should have. When I was a freshman in college, I of course had gigantic fucking speakers in my dorm room, and my roommate and I used to go back to our dorm during the lunch hour when PBS was playing Teletubbies and watch Teletubbies on mute while blasting Nine Inch Nails.
It was
such a great break in the middle of the day.
It sounds like my nightmare on 17 different levels.